generally speaking, that's when you get the best material, when you have a team of people and they're working together and they really have their heart in the right place. I mean, you get good stuff. Sometimes you get just interesting stuff. I like to watch the interesting, weird stuff too, to see what that viewpoint is, you know. Like, there was a movie many, many years ago called The Last Temptation of Christ, which is definitely not accurate, right? But it's not completely inaccurate. And I mean, it's fascinating, the vision of the people involved in that movie going through what, you know, and their focus was an interesting focus, which was his torment. Like, and they did it in weird ways, and it was artistic and everything. But the idea of it was his, you know, his torment, his what he was going through. Because if you consider the fact that Christ was a human being, right, then all this stuff going on, like going into the wilderness and the devil coming to tempt you and all this stuff, would just be massively crazy, right? And so they were trying to deal with what that would be like. You know, if you were just sitting there one day working on carpentry and you know, angels and devils start, you know, start showing up, how crazy would that be? You know, but anyway, you got to take that stuff with a grain of salt. So as for Isaiah, this is the day before Valentine's Day, 13th of February, 22. This year's already racing by. It's already the middle of February. I'm like, what happened? The breakdown of Isaiah, if you're going to like put it in big chunks, we're about to end one particular section in a way. So this is the last. I guess if you put it like this, you would say that the first 39, or let's say, let's go back before that. Let's say the first 35 chapters are sort of the first book of Isaiah, and it is all of the you know, all of the insights from the first, I guess, part of his life or part of the book of Isaiah. And of course, everybody's got extreme questions about how that works, because we're going to switch styles in 36. And the question is, for textual analysis, if Isaiah switches styles, which we can do, right? I can write poetry, and I can write a story, and I can write an analytical essay, right? And I'm not dramatically smarter than Isaiah. I'm probably dramatically less smart than Isaiah, especially when it comes to my connection to God. I try my best, but Isaiah has the main line. My point being that people can switch styles. So is the switch between 35 and 36, when we go from the prophetic poetry and all these prophecies that are pretty broad sweeping, many times we've covered, you know, the whole history of man, basically, all the way to the end. Switch into the story at hand. Is that Isaiah switching to the story at hand? Or is Isaiah writing this prophecy and then someone else, like an assistant or a friend or someone, comes back and says, okay, this is what was going on. Now, it doesn't really matter when it comes down to what's in the text, because God designed the text and every word of the Bible is breathed by God. So it doesn't matter if you breathe it to 17 guys or 7 guys or 1 guy. It's like the discussion of the beginning of the earth. God could make the earth in 7 days. He can make the Earth in 7 seconds. Or he can make it in billions and billions of years. Or we could perceive it in billions and billions of years, and it could be seconds to him. There's all these different viewpoints. None of them change the fact that he made everything and did everything that he did. It's just the technicalities of our discussion. If we want to have a world that's 5 or 6,000 years old, or if we want to have a better explanation for, like, dinosaur bones. So, and I don't like my friend's Bible, the Bible college my friend went to that told him that the devil put the dinosaur bones in the ground to confuse us. Probably a bad answer. It's probably a bad answer. So there probably should be a better answer than that. But anyway, it doesn't really change the facts at hand, right? But you got to figure out, and people ask these questions all the time, like, you know, how many people are on the ark, or how old do those guys really live to be hundreds of years old, or is it hundreds of years in some kind of different time shift? I mean, we got to do the best of what we got. So when it comes to this question, if someone else came and put that information in later and it's still guided by God and it's still accurate, that's fine. That doesn't change anything. I think that Isaiah changes styles myself. I think that there are sections where he's like, this is the words that God has given me. This is the prophecy that's being unfolded. And then this is what's going on. And then this is what that's going to cause. And he's kind of working his way through this whole thing. But it's very, very long, and it confuses people because it's so long and it covers so much ground. So that's part of what we're doing today. 35 is the end of that first 35 chapter section, which we could basically refer to as like the first book of Isaiah. Then there'll be a second book of Isaiah, and there'll be, you know, it's like when you have a play and you have the things that people are saying, and then in between you have stage directions. It's kind of like that. Like, this is what's going on in the world. But 36 to 39 is one of my favorite parts of the whole book, because that is telling the whole story of what happened. And the reason it takes so much time and does it like that is because it's such a big deal. But that's the last of the kings listed in the list of the four kings that he worked for, right? So that means that we have to figure out what that means. Does it mean that he stops, someone else picks up? Or does it mean that he wrote the whole thing and then this piece gets put in? Or what does it mean exactly? So I love that. I love the whole book of Isaiah, and we do get quite a bit of information throughout the book about things that are going on. And of course, you can't not write about this giant thing that's about to happen, because it's one of the biggest, craziest, coolest things that's ever happened in human history. And he just happens to be the guy that's overseeing it. So the way that they end the first large section is important. What have we done for 35 chapters? We've introduced Isaiah, we've introduced the kings that he's with, we've introduced the role that he has, and we've spoken about basically the judgment of God. We've spoken about what's happening in the world, and it's applicable to then, before then, and after then, now, and the end time. We've talked about the coming of a Messiah. We've talked about all the issues that people are having. And we've spent a chapter or two each on all the countries surrounding them and basically out to the whole world. So we've accomplished all of this. And the reason I reiterate all that stuff is because how that section ends is very important. If you were going to write a giant book, you know, 35 chapters, right? you were going to write a giant book and it was an important book of prophecy, how would it end? And that's 35. That's where we are tonight. So let's see how the whole thing that we've done, and you can go back and review, you know, all of Isaiah 1 through 35. And here's how it ends. The wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them. And the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. Okay, so the way the last chapter ended was, we had the day of the Lord's vengeance. We had smoke ascending forever. We had all these cursing things coming on. And one of the kind of scenes that was laid out was this world kind of without people, where the people were all taken away or burned up or whatever it was. And there was this time of peace where the animals were kind of wandering around. Everything was overgrown, but all the animals were in good shape. They had their the courtyards were a place where the jackals could hang out, and the wild goats, you know, wandering around the cities, and you know, everything, you know, the arrow snake, and I don't know why it was an arrow snake, but the arrow snake shall make her nest and lay eggs and hatch them and gather them. I mean, and we had all this stuff, and then nothing is going to fail. So the next verse, starting 35, is the wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them. And the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. And that is an interesting and wonderful passage. It's beautiful. And the reason I say it's interesting is because it says, even with joy and singing. Now that seems to say, and of course it's poetry, so you can read it how you like, but it seems to say that the wilderness and the desert and the blossoms and the trees and nature itself is rejoicing even with singing. And I don't know what the singing of nature is like, but that is a fascinating image. And then we go and we have a name of a place, which is unusual, but the glory of Lebanon shall be given to it. Why would we have a sentence that says, the glory of Lebanon shall be given to it? It's fascinating to me. What is the glory of Lebanon, and why is Lebanon mentioned here at all? Because we don't know anything about Lebanon. We think about Lebanon as this little country that's north of Israel, and Hezbollah and other terrorist groups live there, and they occasionally shoot rockets into Israel, and Israel stomps them, you know, repeatedly, and it's a bad deal. It went on since, you know, the 70s, so most of it, that's like the majority of our lives, right? So we don't know much about Lebanon. But Lebanon was one of the most beautiful places on the planet. It was known for its incredible beauty. And it had two or three things that were really important to the ancient world. One of those things was the best trees. Lebanon is known for cedar. And as you know, still today, cedar is one of the strongest, hardest building materials. So if you want to get planks for your floor, you can get regular planks, you can get cheap planks, you can get good planks, or you can get cedar planks. They're much more expensive, they're much heavier, they're much denser. And it's been like that for thousands of years. Cedar is this thing that they would use for the beams in the big castles and stuff that they would build in the big cathedrals and all the things they would build in the early days before they had a whole lot of, you know, stonework and all those things from the Gothic period and all that stuff. Before that, back in, say, BC, if you're building a major, like, palace for a king, like all these kings we've been talking about, cedar would be something that would be used. This is why dendrochronology, woohoo, Dendrochronology is dating based on tree rings, and it's a specialty field, sub field of archaeology, right? And the reason they're able to do dendrochronological analysis, the reason that they're able to do that is because mostly Lebanon cedar, they'll figure out when something was cut down, right? And if they can ever match things or find stuff that matches, but they'll find it underground and they'll have this thing buried and it'll be a big giant cedar log and it'll still be in good enough shape that they can track these rings and figure out the years. Fascinating. They use that to cross-reference dates and stuff. They got like 10 different ways to cross-reference dates. So it was known for one of the most beautiful things. Also, it had seaports. So it's a land that was just stunning, you know. You know, if you think about like the beautiful part of California, like the whole idea of California in a lot of Americans' minds is this beautiful, you know, green area that's got all the, you know, all this beautiful stuff, like, you know, vines and crops, and then you've got the ocean right there. And that makes it really, really cool. That's why so many people are in California, because they love this type of beauty where you have the mountains and the sea side by side kind of a thing. And that's like Lebanon. Lebanon has the great forests and then the sea. It's this beautiful, beautiful thing. But because they are interwoven with the north and sort of against Israel, they've got a judgment on them. But what happens to that? They get their glory back. Now, this is fascinating for us sitting where we are, because Lebanon has definitely lost its glory. It lost its glory long ago, and it doesn't have it back yet. That could be temporarily in the past when it got its glory back, but it could also refer to the future when it will get its glory back. The excellence of Carmel and Sharon. So Carmel and Sharon is hilarious, but Carmel and Sharon. So that is, these are locations, right, in this area. This is the location of Lebanon. And Mount Carmel, we even have a veterans organization. And I don't know if it's like the third version of that or if it's related, but anyway, they shall see the glory of the Lord, the excellency of our God. So they're talking about that area. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are fear-hearted, be strong, do not fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, he will come and save you. So what's happening is this shift of focus, the shift of like point of view. I'll give you an example. If you're at home and you're just enjoying an evening, you got, you know, a couple young kids, couples at home, popping popcorn, watching a movie, and someone busts in the door, right? And lots of horrible violence takes place. The way that most people see that story has to do with a problem, right? But now let me switch that up. What's happened is there's a person breaking in the back, and some robbers are about to come in this house and rob and steal and kill and destroy these people. And a neighbor driving by has seen that, and he has weapons in his car and military training. So as he watches this guy's jump in the back and he looks through the front window and sees the family, he's like, oh, kicks it in, machine guns, blood everywhere, but now the family's been saved. So you don't necessarily know that when you're sitting on the couch. You know what I'm saying? So you're on the couch eating popcorn, watching, somebody try to find Dory. And this guy kicks the door in and machine guns are going off. And you're like, oh my God, we're all being killed. And you're actually being saved. And that's sort of the point of view shift that's happening. Because God's judgment is doing a great deal of things that seem really horrifying. Like taking out groups of people or taking out areas or burning down cities or whatever it is. Like he's allowing this thing, and these things appear horrible until you change the point of view to the people being saved. And so the fear and the idea of all the suffering that we've had in previous chapters is coming around full circle. And he's saying, tell everybody. See, these people have weak hands, right? They have feeble knees. What they are is they're scared. They're full of fear. They're not able to function. Tell them who are fear-hearted to be strong and do not fear, for God is coming with a vengeance. So, this coming with a vengeance thing goes from a, oh no, we're in trouble thing to a just watch what's about to happen. And this is going to happen in one of the most dramatic ways in the history of the world, where the Assyrian army is dealt with. Then, if they do, if they will calm down and focus, then this is verse 5. But then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For water shall burst forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. It's pretty, for me, that's a really great passage right there. Water shall burst forth in the wilderness, streams in the desert. The parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitation of jackals, where each lay, there shall be grass with reeds and rushes. So this is a transformation of a desert into a lush paradise, right? Now, that may not be a physical, that's poetry, so it may not be a physical description of exactly what's happening. It might not be it might not be an exact physical description. It could be because God is known to make random water appear in the middle of the deserts, and that's why we have things like oasis and all kinds of stories in the Bible. But this idea of a reversal is what we're talking about. Where, so now, this. So there were these palaces and there were these evil kings and there was all this stuff going on. Then that was laid waste and it became a wilderness again. And jackals are wandering around and birds and snakes are living. Everybody and all the animals are happy. And then springing up out of this wasteland comes water and new life. And it's recreating. Right after the destruction. So it's a reversal. In verse 8, a highway shall be there and a road, and it shall be called the highway of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for others. Whoever walks the road, although a fool, shall not go astray. This is getting a little difficult, but also really cool, okay? Because we're taking this transformation, and there's a highway of holiness. And the people that walk it, even if they're fools, even if they don't know how to do everything right, even if they don't know why they're doing it or how they're doing it, as long as they stay on this road, they're going to be okay. They shall not go astray. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast go up on it. It shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there, and the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing, with everlasting joy on their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Now that's the last words before we switch gears. Okay? This is amazing to me. Okay, first of all, it's covering a whole lot of things. One of the things it's covering is the immediate future. There is a country, and everything is fine. And then there's an Assyrian army coming in, and everything is destroyed and burned. And then there's an Assyrian army destroyed that goes away. And then everything grows again. And the people that were hiding and running around trying to find hiding places can all return. So this is the immediate future, where the people that are hiding and running out to Egypt and running off to other countries to try to hide from Assyria and fail, the people that are in hiding will be able to return to Jerusalem, to the temple, and get their lives right. And they'll have a reason to. There'll be great rejoicing and great joy because they will have been saved. This also takes place in the future from there, which is our past, many different times in different ways. One of the things that comes to mind, because we're talking about water coming out of nowhere, we're talking about this road and all these things. One of the next things that comes to mind is Jesus and their walk. And we talk about walking with Jesus, which is really fun to me, that concept. Because when he was here, that's what they did. They walked everywhere. You're walking with Jesus all over the place. And all these miracles were happening. And our lives now are like reflections of that. You know, we're walking with him and miracles are happening. And that's really cool. But obviously, we're also talking about the end. So the end of this section is also the end, because there will be a time, and it says it several times, when there's no more suffering and pain, when all there is joy and gladness. Well, that's exactly what happens at the end of this. So this is obviously related to the road that either leads up to or goes through heaven in the New Jerusalem. We're talking about Zion, we're talking about Jerusalem, we're talking about heaven. So all that is interconnected as well, which is amazing. But then on top of all that, and this is why I go through all that, because it's so Isaiah, because there's also instructions for daily life in here. So we combine the immediate thing that's happening and the future and the far future. And we do so in a way that gives us a hint of how to live. Just imagine this and maybe think on this for, say, the rest of your life, give or take. Okay? Just think about it. There's a highway of holiness. There's a highway. This area where the springs have come out, this area where things are regrowing abundantly, this beautiful place, there's a highway of holiness. You're on the highway. Now, this is very much, in my mind, a symbol of our journey, right, in our lives. Whether you want to call it sanctification or trying to be holy or trying to be more like Jesus or trying to walk with him, or your walk. We have all these terms, right? In modern linguistics, we have all, you know, Christian linguistics, we have these terms like our walk with him. And we have those things like the footprints in the sand and all those kind of things. And it's all about this walk with him. And what this is saying is that So where he walks, obviously, would be holy, right? So there's a highway of holiness. And this is like the narrow path or the roads that Jesus talks about. You're trying to stay on this road. Now, while you're on this road, the unclean shall not pass over it. So people that are, you know, not with Jesus, people that are unclean, we all start unclean, and we're all capable of sin, but we're trying to stay on this path. And even if we're not really good at it, and it uses the word fool, right? Even if we're not good at it, even if we fall a lot, even if we make a lot of mistakes, even if this path is very dicey for us, we just got to stay on this road. If we're on this road, no lions there, no ravenous beasts can get us. If we wander off the road into the field, you know, through the bushes, there's lions and ravenous beasts and all kinds of problems. If we're on the road, they can't get up on it. It's poetry, right? But the way he creates this image, like in my head, it's like this glowing white road type of thing, right? And all around us is wilderness. And if you walk off this road, then, you know, any random thing can happen to you. If you stay on this road, then you're protected. People that you run into on this road are other people like you where they're trying to be on the road. And so those people, the pilgrims on this road, should try to help each other. You know, they should try to work together. They might even meet on a Sunday morning before church in a little room in the back of a church. They should try to stay together on the road, try to help each other on the road. Someone goes over, so, and this hasn't happened, but let's say Bobby is wandering off toward the edge of the road and he's about to trip and fall into the bushes. You know, I can grab onto his shoulder and put my arm around him. Let's get back toward the middle of the road, or vice versa, right? He can help me back on the middle of the road. And we can help each other. And we have endless amounts of literature and meetings about, and men's groups and women's groups and everything else about that concept. The redeemed, it says, the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Now that return can be the immediate future, like we talked about. But that can also be the end. At the end, the ransomed of the Lord shall return. So we're going to all end up in this place. You know, heaven, the New Jerusalem. And there is a great road there. And there is water coming out of places, and there's trees. And I don't know if the animals are in there or the animals are around it. There's gates, there's roads leading to it. If we go all the way back to Revelation and we read how it works, there's roads that lead to heaven, there's gateways, and bad things aren't allowed to come in there. So it's a very similar description. I mean, it's a place where we would be traveling or living. Like I said, I don't know how that works because there's gates and people are allowed to come and go evidently, and I don't really understand. But there are 12 foundations. On them are 12 names of the apostles of the Lamb, and the city's laid out in a square, and it is really big. Gives the descriptions. And the walls are special, and all kinds of precious stones, and it lists all the stones, and the gates were pearls, individual giant pearls, and the streets were like pure gold, like transparent glass. There's no temple in it because God is there. There's no need for a temple. He illuminates it. There's a pure river of the water of life, which proceeds from the throne of God in the middle of the street. On either side of the street was the trees. They're bearing 12 fruits and they're coming into harvest each month. So that description that we have of what it's like, you've got these gates and you've got the names of the tribes written on them, and there's three gates on the east, three on the north and south and west, so there's 12 gates. And if there's gates, when he looks at this, he sees he's carried to a high mountain. He sees this great city. It was like a precious gemstone, this city. It's a really high mountain, by the way, because if you can see that whole city, it's about half as wide as America. So he'd have to be in a pretty significant place to be able to see that city. But anyway, and maybe he's on the moon or something. I don't know. The sky's gone and rolled up. I don't even know what that means. How do you roll up the sky? I don't know. I don't know. I hope that I have a really good seat for all that. Maybe a thing of endless popcorn. Oh, look, it's the thing. It's like locust things with the women here. This is horrible. Anyway, I don't know. I don't know what that's going to be like, but we'll find out sooner or later. But anyway, there's a lot of connectivity between the descriptions of this section as we end this part of Isaiah and that. Overall, like grand summary, overall, closing out the first 35 chapters, like over halfway there, right? I think that this thing that's happening in the time of Isaiah is a representation of everything. I think that the reason that Isaiah exists where he exists, when he exists, and that the reason that all these things happen is a grand representation of everything. I think God is like basically saying, here is a microcosm of all things. This is what happens when you get to live your life and you screw things up. Maybe get that together. Here's what happens if you get really, really bad. Things roll over you and bad things happen. Here's how I can save you. Here's someone coming that's going to be a savior. Buck up, little campers, because when it's all over, everything's going to be fine. As long as you are trying, even if you're a fool, if you're just trying to follow me, if you're just trying to do your best to be holy in some way, I'm going to work with you. I'm going to try to help you get down that road. And it's this kind of summary. And all through the summary is the dangers that are off the path. So, like what this outspoken, smart, atheist college kid doesn't realize is that they're an open target. They don't believe in that, so they think not believing in it will protect you. It's like if you have a tsunami coming towards you and you're on the beach towel sitting on the beach and you're like, I don't believe in tsunamis. It's completely irrelevant. When the tsunami arrives, it's completely irrelevant whether or not you believe in tsunamis. You're about to be swept away and drowned and killed. If you believed in tsunamis, you would make your way to high ground and be protected. And it's pretty simple. So one of the reasons we're not supposed to judge is when somebody's spouting off whatever nonsense they're saying. It's not our job to judge because we should feel bad. We should actually try to come up with ways to help them if we can, because the problem is they're on the beach sipping a Mai Tai when a tsunami's coming, and all around them people are saying, "Have you seen the report from the Geographic Institute for Oceanography? There's been an earthquake a couple hundred miles away. There's probably a giant tsunami coming. We're headed to the mountains in my VW bus. Hop in." And they're like, "Nah, I don't believe in tsunamis. Like, but you understand all the evidence. There's just piles of evidence of tsunamis that if they've existed for all of time. Like, yeah, no, I've seen all that. But, you know, I think, you know, people are weak, and weak people come up with excuses to help themselves, like tsunami. Right? Like, okay, that's an interesting point of view. Good luck. I mean, at some point, you got to get in the van and get out of the way of the tsunami. You got to leave the guy on the beach, which is sad. But that's what this is about. This is about all you got to do is just pay a little bit of attention. It's like Jesus said with the mustard seed. Mustard seeds are itsy bitsy. They're so tiny. All you need is the faith of a mustard seed, and you're going to be okay. If you can just get that much faith together. Because Jesus knows. He was human, right? He knows life is hard and we're getting hit all the time. And everything's crazy. You know, most of us don't face some of the trials and tribulations that some of the guys in the Bible do. Like, how easy would it be for John the Baptist to get out of prison? Real easy. All he would have to do is recant what he said about Herod. Say, no, it's cool. I would like to bless Herod's marriage to his brother's wife. And, you know, as one of the local holy men, you guys are good. He'd be at the party instead of his head being at the party. But that's not how this works. He's staying on that road. He's staying in the middle of that road, and he's helping as many people. He's not even walking down the road. John the Baptist is standing in the road, helping other people get down the road, like right this way, just right here. Do not go that way or that way. Stay right here. And he's telling people, thousands of people, and helping these people down this road. Thousands of people he's getting down this road. He's like, when my time is over on this road, I'm still good. I'm still on the road. So the way he's seeing that is, you cut my head off, me and my head are laying on the road. I didn't jump off the road and get my head cut off. I stayed on the road. And people that get that far down the road have very interesting points of view. Like, you read about the end of people's lives that were hardcore believers, people that have helped tens of thousands of people come to God, right? They're getting killed, and their viewpoint of that is very different than most humans. You know, like, they take Ignatius and they drag him all the way from, you know, from the Holy Land all the way, you know, to Rome, where they're going to kill him. And they're going, you know, he's got guards taking him around, and you know, other guys are coming to see him on the road. So you got this guy who's a prisoner in chains, being taken, old guy, being taken to be executed. And the guards are just kind of in awe of this guy. They are Roman citizens. They're all Roman centurions. They are going to take him to be killed. But they're in kind of an awe, and they're taking him, and he's like, hey, can we got to go to Rome. So if we could take that road instead of that road, because more people can come see me on the way. And they're like, sure. And they go up through this right way, and, you know, people that he's trained, and people that have their own, that are bishops on their own right, with their own churches, are coming to see him. He's getting visitors on this journey. Everybody's coming to see him and talk to him about everything. What's your final words for me? And he's telling him, you know, God loves you or whatever. He's telling him, here's the fun. And he's making his way to Rome to be killed. And he's all kinds of happy. All these people come to see him. And he's like, look at all these people. The ministry that we've had, that God has allowed us to have, has brought all these people, you know. That's so much bigger than me. That's how he's thinking. It's so much bigger than me. Look at all these churches. And then, you know, some really important figures, you know, will come and see him just to get their last words from him and stuff. And then they'll go back and take this last words from this, you know, great man of God back to their churches. And he's just lifting people up the whole way. And they get there and they're like, you're going to kill you now. And, you know, if you don't, you know, recant your whole God thing, you know, and I can see, because they don't have any idea, right? The Romans are clueless. They're like, you know, we don't understand. They really are baffled with Christians, because there's so many Roman gods. All I need you to do is say Apollo is, you know, Apollo's not as important as emperor, or, you know, Aphrodite is not as important as Apollo. It doesn't make any difference to them. None of that makes any difference. So they don't understand. All you need to do is say God is not that big a deal. The emperor is a big deal. And you're good. That's all you need to do. So they can't understand why I won't do it, because they don't want to kill him, because he's an old guy, really old guy. They don't want to kill him. They're like, we don't want to kill you. All you need to do is recant God, you know, recant Jesus and God, and claim the emperor, you know, as the most important person, and then everything will be okay. And he says, no. He says, look, God's never turned his back on me. And these are non-Christian people writing down what he said. God's never turned his back on me. Why would I turn my back on him now? At this long of a journey, at this end of the road, why would I go and do something like that? Why would I deny Jesus or turn my back on God after this entire life and everything that I've seen? Like, well, we're going to throw you in the pit with the beasts, and they're going to tear you to pieces. And he's like, well, hopefully I'm full enough, you know, of the bread of life. Hopefully I'm like grain, and their teeth are good, like grinders. They're going to grind me into more flour for more bread of life. They're like, we have no idea what that means. You're a crazy person. You know, and then they throw him in there, and beasts tear him to pieces. He's cool with that. He's like, whatever. You know, the people that are like that have gone down that road like so long. Like, imagine John when they put him into boiling oil. They're going to kill John and they're going to put him in boiling oil. They're going to boil him in oil. And he's in there like a hot tub chilling. And they're like, why is this guy not dying? He's like, you guys should probably read chapter 7 or whatever. You know, it's like, hey. Remember that? Remember Jesus and the guy that I had my head on his lap? They're like, no. He's like, we should probably look it up, because that's why this isn't going to work. He doesn't want me to die right now, so I'm just not going to die. When he wants me to die, I'll die. Right now, he doesn't want me to die, so I'm afraid there's nothing you can do about that. But they tried to kill some of these guys, and they couldn't even kill them. And it was like John. Or they one guy, they burned him, it didn't work. They stabbed him, it didn't work. They're like, how do we kill this guy? I mean, and I believe that people doing that were changed. That the reason God did that and let that happen is because a bunch of those guys probably went away later on and probably started thinking about it and probably had some kind of dream 2 years later and became like preachers, some of those guards. We know some of the guards at the cross were saved at the cross. Some of the centurions were like, what is really going on right now? You can't stop that. The power of God is there. And even if you're a non-believer, even if you hate it, you can't stop the fact that that wave hits you, that you're just witnessing something that doesn't make any sense, that God has to be here. And it changes your point of view. And these guys go off with their lives later on, and they're walking around in their lives going, man, what was that about? Well, I don't understand. We burned that guy, and he didn't even make a noise. He looked at me, and he was smiling. And I went forward just like, because I was going to stab him some more. And he looked, and he pointed, and his arm was on fire. And he was like, do you see that? And I was like, I didn't see anything, but like the sky. He's like, that is so beautiful. What is it? What is going on? I said, they start thinking, if I die, because I'm going to die, everybody's going to die, I would really like to see something beautiful and be super happy. when I'm dying. That would be crazy. Instead of being like scared and miserable and screaming in pain. Wow, something's going on. See, here's the catch. The catch is that level of faith is not possible in general, especially in large numbers. That level of faith is not possible in nothing. So you can have faith in something that's not real, but large amounts of people can't have faith all the way to dying in something that's not real. It's like this argument you can't get around if you're trying to be an anti-believer. You can't get around this argument, because if I'm making something up and you go to kill me, I stop making it up, right? I say, never mind, I was kidding. You know, that's what you do if you're making up. If I'm like, hey, man, you know, I was born in this Silver Mountain, and the Silver Mountain goddess walks with me. If I'm making something up, when you go to stab me in the face, I say, I'm just kidding. I made that stuff up about the Silver Mountain goddess. That's a whole thing in my head. That's not real. But if you go stab me in the face, and I'm going to be like, yeah, that's cool. There has to be something some depth behind that, right? Because these guys all have a chance. The Romans like to give those guys chances, right? Like, you're on the woodpile. I have the torch. All you got to do is say, Jesus, you know, you made this stuff up about Jesus. Over and over again, there was this preacher named Jesus. He died on a cross. We buried him. You stole his body and made this whole thing up, right? Like, no, he came to see me. He was alive. I'm going to burn you now. If you were making that up, if you were a disciple that stole his body and made it all up, right when they lift that thing, you'd be like, okay. Bucket of water, please. I'm sorry. And not one of thousands recants anything. You can't, it doesn't matter how smart you are as an atheist leader or an anti-Christian leader. It doesn't matter how smart you are. There is no argument for that. Thousands of people do not get burned and killed. And so many people got killed, they used their body to light streets. They put Christians up as lamps and burned their bodies as lamps in streets. That's how many people. No, nobody lets themselves get burned over a theory. I don't know how it works. Hopefully I'll never get burned and used as a lamp. But if I did, I would imagine that there'll be Jesus or an angel or something right there. It's okay. First thing I'm going to do, take away all the pain. Like, I'm on fire, but you're not burning, right? Yeah, I'm good. Can they see you? No, they can't see me. Well, you're good. Just relax. It's going to be all right. We're going to go see him in a sec. Like, okay, why are they putting me up on the pole? They want to light their streets. That's awful. Like, yeah, it's really awful, but that's okay. You're okay, right? I feel great, man. This is awesome. Are you kidding me? What are all the lights? We're almost there now. Well, you'll see him in a sec. Like, that's great. I really get to see him. Yeah, you get to see him. That's so cool. And meanwhile, the guards are like, why is this guy talking to himself and smiling? That's completely, completely insane. When that happens 1,000 times, I guarantee you there's guards that quit lighting people. They're like, I'm not doing this job anymore. I quit. There's something going on. The last four guys giggled. I am out. You know, I don't know. I wasn't there. But right now we got as many martyrs now as we've ever had. People are being put to death today. Throughout the world. I like to think that the majority of that has to do with the same thing we saw with the very first martyr. Stephen is the very first one, and they're stoning him to death. And he is like, this is awesome. Can you see Jesus's face, you guys? Look how cool this is. This is the greatest. And they're like, what is he talking about? And they do the pain, and they just take away the pain. It's the very end. We don't have their discussion later of what happened, because they're all dead. So we don't have them going later on. So this is what happened. So we have to make an assumption that it's a lot like Stephen, which is no pain. I don't feel any, I'm getting hit by rocks. I don't really feel it. And to me, the way I envision that is my mind being kind of separated, you know, like, because I've got this whole thing that's functioning together right now, mind, body, spirit, all in one package. But we all know about people that are on the, you know, in the hospital dying and they raise up above their bodies, that there's a separation. There's these other things going on. I don't fully comprehend, but there's obviously a spirit and a soul and things like that going on. Well, I kind of feel like this, like if an angel or Jesus himself came to stand beside me and he just basically that like lifts me a little bit out of my body, right? So I'm just disconnected. So now I'm not really connected to the pain. So it's like a distant thing where there's thunk, thunk, thunk. These are rocks hitting me, breaking bones. They're going thunk, thunk, thunk. And it's like a far away, like, thunk, 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 thunk. And I'm just like, hey, man, how's it going? Wow, look at that. Wow. Can't wait till John writes this all down. Because that's not, Revelation hadn't been written yet. So I don't have a description for this. It looks like a giant gem. I don't understand. It's like glowing. And I'm like, but I can't really feel it. That's my envisioning of it. I don't know. I don't know if that's right or not. But you have a whole lot of stories of Christians that martyrs at the end that are just not that concerned about this whole killing me thing, which is truly bizarre because human beings are not like that. That's like the scaredest and craziest life ever is. But for these guys, they're like, it's like the girl when, you know, when they were doing the school shooting and they were asking people if they were Christians or whatever. And the one young girl was just like, yeah. They're like, well, you better change your mind right now. It's like, nah, Jesus, man. She had that same thing in that same moment of like infinite suffering and tragedy and fear. She was fearless. She was like, nah, man, Jesus. You do whatever you're going to do. Jesus. You know, does that guy get that now? Or is that guy, you know, never going to get that? I don't know. Anyway, that's what this is. The size of what we're talking about, that idea of how we're supposed to live and how we're supposed to die and that whole thing, that's how this first 35 chapters ends. There is a highway of holiness. Unclean people are not passing on it. There is no danger on it. There is no suffering and pain. Get on it. Stay on it. No matter if you're a moron and you can't even figure out where you're at, just try to stay on this road. You know, we make mistakes, we stumble and fall. Get back up, stay on this road. Right? What if I get shot at? It's okay, duck, stay on this road. What if I get hit with a spear? Pull it out, stay on the road, keep walking on the road. And that's how this whole thing ends. And I think the reason for that, and this is sort of the final word for today, but I think the whole reason for all of that is because there's about to be this massive example. The people in Jerusalem are being told all of this, and then this massive army surrounds them. They all are going to die. There is no way not to die. They're all going to die. This is the biggest army anyone's ever seen. It's 10 times bigger than any army they could get together. It's the end. And then a lot of those people are staying cool. And a lot of those people are panicking. And then God's about to fix it. And he said he was going to fix it. And he does fix it. And now he fixed it. And now you sit there going, was I the guy that stayed cool and believed? Or was I the panicking person running around? Who was I when that happened? And that's a microcosm of our lives, of all the lives of all humans from beginning to end. That's the microcosm of it. Who was I? Was I the person who stayed strong and believed and tried to stay on that road? Or was I the person who panicked and fled off the road trying to run to Egypt run through the bushes right into the lions. And that's the whole point. And now that we have all of that prophecy and poetry explaining God's words to people, now, next class, bring your friends, okay? Because the next class is the story of what happened when God showed them physically how it works. He's going to do a demo. He's going to do a little demo of how this works. And it's going to be a demo that's going to last for all time. And 2,700 years later, we're going to be talking about it because it's that big of a demo, demonstration of who he is and what he'll do. And we just have to get our head around part of it and stumble down the road. Any questions or comments about that? I'd love Isaiah so much. And I'm excited. I'm excited for 36. 36 through 39, you know, because I'm a historian type of guy. And I love the story of what actually happens, you know. And they've had this build up. They've been hearing all this stuff. And now here it is. Are you going to listen to what he was saying, what God was saying through Isaiah? Or are you going to be like, crazy, what are you going to do? And luckily, Hezekiah does the right thing. But all right, let's pray. Whew. Heavenly Father, that went by quick. Thank you so much for this day and this time in your word. We get excited about this stuff because it's so important to our lives now. You're so important to our lives now. Lord, we want more of you every day. We want you to have your way with us, with our lives. Please bless and protect everyone here, the folks that would love to be here but aren't. Everybody, you know, that is close to us, please bless and protect everyone here. Bless them and protect them as they travel, as they drive around, you know, in the weather, their health with all the types of diseases and every other problem that can occur, their families, all of our families, which are so complicated. Have your way with them. Be inside of all those things. Do miracles in our lives. Our health, our homes, protect our homes, you know, from fire and theft and all those things that can happen. Please protect us. Our jobs, our daily lives, just have your cocoon around us, your blessing, your protection at all times. That's our fervent prayer from our hearts, Lord, that you be in our lives. We thank you so much for this time together and being in your word. Please keep us able to do this. And thank you so much for this place and our leaders and this church. Just bless and protect the leaders of Radiant. Bless the message today. Keep us strong and help us stay on that path. Lord, we love you with all of our hearts and we thank you with all of our hearts. Stick with us. We pray these things in the mighty, unstoppable name of Jesus Christ. Amen. The centurion.